warrior's mindset is about conditioning the mind, body, and spirit. It takes practice, commitment, vision, goal setting, determination, sharp focus, respect, and discipline. Once you learn it, you can apply it to all aspects of your life. The warrior's mindset prepares you for the largest competition ever, the competition against self.
Okay, everybody. Willie Bam Johnson once again here too. Willie Bam Johnson's Warrior's Mindset. You know what this show is about. It's about tapping down inside your body, mind, and soul to be able to overcome all the obstacles that, you know, we face each and every day. We know we got COVID, but we got other things. We got anxiety. We got overwhelming stress. We just got so much going on. But when you dig down inside yourself and you let go, you let God, guess what we do? We overcome the obstacles and we flip the script for greatness. And that's what this show is about. It ain't about no negativity. It's about positivity. It's about solutions. And when you tune in and we work together, we can bring about those solutions in the world. I mean, and also we got to believe that anything's possible. And this show, once again, is a blessing that came from Mr. Jesse Bowen, but that, our guests, man, and we didn't have all kinds of people on this show. I mean, but the one person we have right now, Mr. Warren Hutland, it's like, oh my God, man, how do I say that I don't think he realizes that through all my struggles when I was homeless and going through things, entertainment can change you and help you get over an obstacle and make it to the next stage. And his movies from House Party to Boomerang, just little things just to give you a glimmer of hope, and then to have him in my life as a friend, as an advisor. I mean, I'm just truly grateful, sir. And I'm honored that you're on our show. For the world, can you give them an intro on who you are and give them a little bit about your greatness?
Well, first of all, I thank you for your kind words, but also I think some of it is exaggeration, because what I've been trying to do is I've been in the film business. I made my very first film when I was still a student. This was back in 1974. I got some time in. Yes, and back in those days, black film didn't exist. Yes, sir. And there was a film made by a person who became my mentor, Melvin Van Peeples. And it was like revolutionary. I said, wow, I need to consider this. And so then I began the journey to begin to finally use cinema and then later television to tell our story. Yes, I realized that unfortunately, our story was not being told, mm-hmm. or it was being told in a way that made us look bad, made us less than. And so I feel like I took the responsibility to take up the responsibility to even out that story, to correct that story. I've been trying to do that for almost 50 years now. And in that process, what I discovered was that our story as people of color in this country is so dynamic, so exciting, and so entertaining that even though they had not been telling it, when I presented to them, they said, oh yeah, we'll finance that. And so that opened the door to the commercial work I've done, whether it be House Party, which was their debut movie. By the way, it was on TV last night, I was watching it. and of course, Boomerang with Eddie Murphy. And then I did the very first ever black animated film, Bay Bay's Kids.
Oh yeah, I didn't know, I forgot about that one, okay.
Yeah. And then I moved to television. I did a series on HBO called Cosmic Flop with George Clinton. It's not about music, it was kind of a social science fiction drama. And I did a documentary called Unstoppable, which I interviewed the three pioneers of black cinema. That was Melvin Van Peebles, Gordon Parks, and Ossie Davis. And so more recently, I'm really very interested in virtual reality, which is something that most people don't know about, but when they finally take a look, it's gonna blow your mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I think you know it, and I just want you to know, I would never exaggerate with how you have affected me. And many people, a lot of times I tell people, I'll meet them, I say, man, it was because of your poster on the wall that I made it from the projects. And I don't think they understand how important that is. And I believe, especially when we talk about young kids that are just trying to find hope, they're in the ghetto or they're in the street, you know what I'm saying? We don't understand, some people don't understand the power of a song, the power of a movie, the power of a piece of clothing, the power of a comic book, Those things on a spiritual vibration level can change a kid's life. And if they can get confirmations over and over that, oh, this can happen, this could be me, that's the power of entertainment. And to me, how important is for, I guess, those behind telling the story, for them to monitor and be conscious of what message they are putting out there to other people?
You know, if I have any disappointment, the thing you just outlined, that consciousness, that awareness of that impact, not enough people focus on that. It's obvious to you, it's obvious to me. And so therefore we have to be very responsible with our storytelling. And oftentimes the glamour and the money in Hollywood is such that you lose sight of that responsibility. You just get the dollar and you tell stories that are silly or stories that are dishonest. And that to me, I kind of judge very harshly. Fortunately, a couple of filmmakers who really do a great job. One came out last year, which I'd like to bring to everybody's attention. And one's coming out next month, which I want to bring to your attention. One that came out last year, interesting enough, is a Black movie by a Black man who's French. It's called Les Miserables. If you, anybody who's watching has Amazon Prime, you can watch it. It's subtitled, but it's really amazing because the experience of Black people struggle, contemporary struggle in France, in suburbs outside of Paris, the same as what's happening. In many ways, that story, Les Miserables, anticipated what we saw with George Floyd. It's all about the kind of police abuse in France. But the movie is coming out next week. I think it's February 12th or 13th. And this is going to be on the HBO Max. It's called Judas and the And it's again, it's a document. Well, it's a historical, based on a historical person from my generation, a man named Fred Hampton. He was the founder of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, Illinois. And he was very influential on me. And for those who probably never heard that name before, I would suggest that you tune in and watch that story. He was an incredibly dynamic person. And the cast is fantastic, the people you know. One of the lead characters in Black Panther, Daniel, I'm gonna mispronounce his last name, his African name. And it's just a really, really, really good movie. And for those of us who were young and were not there when the Black Panther Party was dominant, it's a good insight into that period of time. But that's a period of time that had tremendous influence on me as a young person. So I'm glad that this filmmaker, Shaka King is his name, made this film so people can look back to that time, because it's my favorite saying that history isn't past, you know, it's still present.
Yes, sir. You know, two questions you just bring up from what you just said. One, we always have had to have a warrior's mindset. I think about my mom and I think about my dad, where got to try not to get emotional about this, but just to see how they did the best with what they had. And some people might look at it as being, oh man, you should have had a better life, but without the life that they gave me, by having a warrior's mindset, they made sure we had what we needed. You know, they didn't worry about blinging or whatever. They wanted to make sure that they can provide, you know, warm food on the table, clothing on your back. As a people, you know, and we really need, I think people misinterpret that, how we learn to adjust and flip the script and make the best of whatever we got. How would you describe that, sir, when you think of that level of being a warrior and committed to being your best?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think there's a presumption that there's a correlation between the hand you dealt, where you grew up, the circumstances, that's going to determine your outcome. And many times it has an undue influence. But one of our greatest leaders of all time was Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm X, his mother was unfortunate. She was mentally ill. And that really traumatized. His father was murdered by the Ku Klux Klan when he was young. And he got into, in the early days, he was involved, you know, in a lot of petty crime. But once he got involved with the Nation of Islam, he completely transformed his life. And then another point in his life, he decided to leave the Nation of Islam and move into another persona. But Malcolm X is a person, if you look at him on paper, he should have never done any of the things he did. Never. He had no possibility. But he had willpower. He had discipline. He had desire. and he had a raw intelligence that's able to analyze his experience and see possibilities. So all of us, you know, I mean, being born, we get dealt a hand. Okay, hand may be a good hand, maybe a bad hand. But the real question is, how do you play your hand? And my brother, let me take this moment to praise and acknowledge you. You played your hand brilliantly. You had some extremely hard times, but you did it so well. The fact that anybody who meets you, I think, you know, we've measured over time, but one day you were speaking in Newark. And I walked over to you, I said, brother, I've met you multiple times, but I've never heard you speak. And that just, I mean, I was down with you anyway, but when I heard you speak, I said, no, I got to serve you, but I got to serve your message, because what you're doing is so important to all people.
Well, you know, it's funny, and I thank you for that. You know, Malcolm X changed my life.
Yes, sir.
When I got in trouble, you know, I knew I had to change. Nobody, and this is, I think we, sometimes everybody don't understand when we get in trouble, even when we see the challenges facing the youth, nobody rehabilitates you. Nobody give you help. They lock you up in the jail and it's it, you're in the jail. You know, but once again, I guess that question that I was asking you, my mom and my dad prepared me for a better life. Sorry. They prepared me for a better life. So when I was in hell, I knew that now the student had to be open to the teacher's method.
Yes, sir.
The thing I did everything that Malcolm did. I read the dictionary. I read the Bible front to back. I read every book I can get my hand on. So I think even during this time, it's so important that we learn to rehabilitate ourselves and educate ourselves. And you just keep talking about the history. And I was in the Nation of Islam. You know, that was the element. I mean, they said, always have a watch, always have a pen, and always have a pad. And men don't sit this way. Men sit this way. And the beautiful thing, and I can say that, you bringing out things that I just sometimes just choose not to talk about to people, but I was a captain in the Nation of Islam.
Yes, sir.
And the beautiful thing about when I was locked up, wherever God was speaking, I was allowed to go to. It didn't matter if it was Christianity, whatever, because I don't believe that God has a label. He's everywhere.
That's right.
But I think what happened when I was a captain, they allowed me to speak about racial harmony, because when I went to China, I was treated like I was a king in China. And I was like, hold up, but nobody never treated me like that. So why would I even want to talk like that? Mm-hmm. So I think it goes back to such understanding your history and have a broader perspective. We'll realize that once we know who we are, we can adapt to everybody and accept everybody, because it doesn't take away who we are. And we're bigger than, you know, we're kings and queens. Am I sounding right here, sir? I'm sorry.
What you're talking about is a type of validation that comes from the spirit, that comes from within. It doesn't come from the outside. So it doesn't make a difference what the government says, even what your friends say. It's what you know from inside. And that's something you can taste, you can feel.
Yes, sir.
No matter, nobody can say anything to you. They cannot discourage you. They cannot stop you. In fact, that document I mentioned before about Mel Van Peebles and Gordon Parks and Ozzie Davis was called Unstoppable. Because once you reach the zone of being unstoppable, outside figures, you know, that's just the race you got to run. But it has nothing to do with your success, because as long as you are breathing, you in the struggle. And if you ain't breathing, then okay, it's over. But until as long as I breathe, this goes on. And I remember, you may know, I'm sure you know my one of my teachers is Lil John Davis.
Yeah, okay,
and,
yes, sir.
Yeah, and so we'd be in class and time. We, you know, this is, you know, I'm you know, I came up in the 70s, you know.
Yes, sir. Okay.
And we had those safety punches. That came later. So we spar hard. And one day the guy come, bam, he dropped me, man. I was on the floor. I was hurt. And I'm just laying there. I didn't even get up. I was hurt. He walked over to me. He said, let me ask something. I'm looking up at him. He said, is your heart still beat? I said, yeah. I said, are you still breathing? I said, yeah. He said, didn't get up. And he was talking about the context of Kumite, but it's about life. If your heart's still breathing and you're still breathing, do you get up? You will get knocked down. That's not important. What's important is will you get up? And it applies to everything in your life. You know, 9 times down, 10 times up. And if we embrace that philosophy, it'll be unstoppable.
Yes, sir. And you study Tai Chi, and I understand that, you know, when it's funny, I can speak, I think people accept it now. I speak freely about things that happened to me because that was the greatest lessons that happened to me. I made the best of them. So that I learned that my greatest wealth is my story.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That's more valuable than anything else that I own on the planet. So,
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You know, I think about when I got in trouble and I realized that, whoa, man, I'm claustrophobic. I can't handle being incarcerated. But what I realized is that, hold up, I've been alive in this place for more than a week. That means I have became one with the environment. And what my instructor was talking about the chi and flowing and being like water, it happened. It wasn't something that I thought about. I was like, man, I'm living this. So I'm in tune to that. How important is understanding that energy and allowing the energy to do for you what you cannot do for yourself?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, let me just contextualize what I'm saying. I started martial art training in 1968.
Okay.
So I got a lot of years. And so what I've come to understand is that martial arts is a philosophical system. And so you need, and each art has a different philosophical underpinning. And the reason why these many years later, I moved into Chinese martial arts, specifically Tai Chi, is that before the Japanese arts I studied, which I love, much respect, please don't misunderstand anything I'm about to say, but it was adversity comes and I crush it, I break it, I beat it. I was fire against fire. And now when fire comes at me, now I put water on it. You know, if you punch at me, I disappear. I mean, it's philosophical. It's a different way to respond to conflict. It doesn't mean that you surrender. But you neutralize. And Tai Chi is neutralize, redirect, and repel. And so that whole neutral, so I'm constant, every time I have a conflict now, it's so funny. I believe that you use your martial art in daily life. So I was debating with some movie executive. And they said something to me, and I know in the past I've been in a fight. I knew that's it. Why? And I just didn't resist. I just redirected the energy. And they kept trying to get me into a fight. I wasn't gonna give it. Because first of all, it was no win. They got the money, I'm trying to get the money. So fight for what? And so, but they were stunned that they couldn't get me to fight. And that is a Tai Chi principle. And each martial art has a principle. And sometimes you do need to fight. I mean, one of my really close friends is Sifu Carl Albright from Seven Star Praying Mantis. The Praying Mantis is a dangerous martial arts. I mean, a mantis would just eat you up. And so there are occasions when you need to do that, you know, but you decide in terms of your personality, what works for you and what art works for you. And so when we look at martial arts, whatever style you pick, you have opportunity to understand what is the founding principle of that art. And if you understand the founding principle, then you apply it through your whole life. It's not something in the gym or in a ring or even on the street. What is the principle? I mean, it really disturbs me when people don't do that work. Therefore, you see guys in a tournament and they're supposed to be this style, but they start fighting, everybody looks the same. They're all doing kickboxing. So then why study this or that? Just kick the bag all day. You know, all you're gonna do is kickbox. But if you're gonna learn a specific, whether it be Mantis or Tiger or Shotokan or Goju. I mean, back in the old, you're too young, man. You remember a guy named Fred Miller? That's way back.
Okay.
Yeah, this brother, he did Goju. This is back in the 70s. When he fought, you saw Goju. He looked like he was doing a kata. He was a champion. But everything he did was perfect Goju. And I said, wow, okay. So if you do Goju, you see, if a Goju man fights a Shotokan man, you should see the difference.
Yes, yes.
You know, but if a Taekwondo man fights a kickboxer, you see, I mean, if you Bagua Tai Chi, what you need to see. Otherwise, what were you doing?
Yeah. all
you're just going to throw blows, then, you know, why spend hours and hours and hours training? So understand what is the principle of your art. Choose wisely and then apply it. And apply it now in gym, but in life.
You know, when you say that, I think of my traditional system is called Tien Shin Pai.
Mm-hmm.
It means school of thought. And it's if people understand it, we graduate to internal arts. It's like all the violence that we see in the world. One of my instructors, Master Brown, when everybody at one time I think we went through an era in martial arts where you wouldn't see no bloodshed. You wouldn't see a poster with somebody hitting somebody in the throat. It was just like good loving expressions. And now all of a sudden you see people being beat to a pulp in a ring with nothing but blood.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, you know what? We get ready to go back to peace again. But you got to go through the blood to get to the peace. And it's the yin and the yang.
That's right.
And now you see it with so much violence going on in the world. There's no other way but to go to peace, harmony, and happiness for that moment. And that's why you see so many people in yoga, and you see so many people trying to do internal arts and meditation, because that's the graduation. But I think a lot of maybe Western arts lack that aspect. We spend so much time on the external, and we neglect the internal.
You being very polite by saying that, man. Western culture is, unfortunately, is a culture of barbarians, man. There's total barbarians. But before I go into that, the grandmaster of that of your style, is that Willie Lin?
Yes, Tony Lin and Willie Lin.
I met Willie Lin a couple years ago.
Okay.
First of all, I looked at his face. Now you look at my face, brother. I mean, I'm holding on, but he looked younger than me. He's 80 years old. I couldn't believe how old he was. And more importantly, when I introduced him, he stood up. I shook my hand like, I ain't nobody. You, I mean, and his humility,
yes,
his face and his humility, it just disarmed me, man. That was all the kung fu I needed to see. I mean, when he has internalized his character, I don't care. I don't care if he can kick punch nothing. He's living it.
Yes.
And that really touched me. I mean, I was like super impressed, man. Super impressed. So you radiate your martial arts. I gotta tell you one of my mother's story, man. There's a few people you meet in life who really take the art and completely take it inside, and it's complete. Again, this guy, I'm gonna say it, you're not gonna know his name. Only people in New York, very few people in New York know him, but he's a legend. His name is Carl Riley, popularly known as Aikido Carl. He's one of the first Black guys to get involved in Aikido way, way back.
Okay.
And he's very eccentric. I mean, he's the kind of guy, he had a dojo full of people and came in every day and says, okay, everybody must leave. Why? What do we do? He says, he had like 100 people in the school. He said, you all got to leave. He says, why? He says, because you don't practice with the correct spirit. Aikido has a spirit. You don't have a spirit. I can't teach you. Everybody was shocked. I mean, it's money walking out the door.
Right.
And he financially, he's in bad shape because he refuses to leave the spirit. So one day he showed up and everybody, oh my God, Carl's here, right? So he knows me and we love to talk. So I'm sitting in the big gymnasium, sitting there talking with him. People on the opposite side of the gymnasium are pointing. They say, oh my God, he's here. Everybody's excited, he's here, right? So one guy crosses the gym and comes over to me and bows. And so I was talking to me. Like, I'm trying to figure out, I don't know this guy. He said, oh no, he said, I'm told you're a great master. I wanted to meet you. And I look at the guy, and I started laughing. He said, no. Not me, it's this man sitting next to me. But you think it's me because I have ego. And so you feel my ego. You walk to me because I'm feeling something.
Right.
But the guy who's so advanced, he's invisible to you. His level is so high, you can't see it. And that's the high level of mastery. And that just told me everything. This guy, his Aikido, I tell you, man, his Aikido is sublime. It's another word for it. It's just unbelievable.
When you mention that, I think of, once again, my experience. I always tell people, because everybody talk about killing and combat, and sometimes people don't think Kung Fu is effective. It's not the art that's effective, it's the individual that's effective. That's what I try to get people to understand.
That's right.
But I always tell people, and this is not being like trying to make a racial statement, but it's a real statement. A lot of times, I remember when I first ran my school, people used to come and they say, where's the teacher? I said, it's me. And they said, oh, well, where's the Chinese teacher? And I think a lot of people don't understand the depth of experience that we bring to the arts from our own struggles in those communities. And it's some devastating struggles when we learn to adapt our experiences to the art. But what the point I was trying to make when I got locked up, I never got in one fight. And I was in a maximum security prison, and they allowed me to practice martial arts every day. You ain't supposed to practice martial arts at all in that situation. But I remember there was other men that told me when I would have these encounters, they would say, look, what do you want to do? Do you want to go home to your kids, or do you want more time? And I would say, I want to go home. They say, well, go apologize to that man. Now, sir, imagine walking through, you know, a cafeteria of hundreds of strong killers, because this is a max security prison, and you got to go and say hello. You got to go and say, I'm sorry, I don't want no trouble, I just want to go home. And they would say, yeah, all right, get out my face. And I ain't gonna say all the other words they would say. But the beautiful thing that I learned from that is that I was able to go into a hell and not get in one fight and earn the respect of the other warriors, because I had the courage to say I'm sorry. We teach the opposite of that to our kids, like fight, fight, fight. The real warrior don't have to fight. Biggie Smalls say, killers move in silence. We don't have to, just be humble. And how important is it? And you said that even in your business dealings, how important is it to let, just be like water, let it go. It'll turn out the way it needs to turn out, because once again, the spirit's in charge. How important is that, once again, sir?
But to take your story, man, to add another layer to that, there's the humbleness of a lion different from the humbleness of a lamb. So when you went to those killers and say, hey, I just want to go home. Now, they accepted your apology and the people sent you there, but they knew, they felt that you weren't saying I'm sorry because you were scared, because you were trying to go home. And I think he could accept that, because if he was really soft and scared, then they wouldn't accept it that.
Right.
And so when we tell anyone to be humble, it's not out of fear, it's out of internal confidence. And so hopefully people will accept that. But if they don't accept that, then it goes to the yin becomes yang, that's what happens. But strategically, we are challenged to understand these principles and put them in place. And everything is in the fight. I mean, it really literally should be that kind of brute combat or even brute action. It's crude. It's the last level. You should not get there. You should be, at these many years, know how to move in such a way that, I think I was talking to C4 Carl Albright yesterday. He told me some history that I didn't know, about the founding of Bagua. You probably know this, but I didn't know it. And he said that Bagua, the person who created Bagua, was a waiter in the imperial court. And he was not a martial art practitioner. He was carrying trays to serve the royalty. And a lot of people in the court, it was very crowded. He could walk around holding the tray on one hand, how Bagua said, and move around to the crowd and serve him back. And he was like, and the general said, look at that guy. And they couldn't believe that he was weaving out the crowd, put the drinks down, and never bumped to anybody.
Right.
And so they saw this, they saw the marshal. This guy's simply doing his job. And so they recruited. So listen, man, I see what this can be. So they took this sublime movement and put a martial application to it. But it's these principles. I mean, understand these principles of movement. And it's really, really deep. And I've never heard that story before, and it really impressed me.
I studied Bagua when I was in China. That was one of the arts I got a chance to work on. But and this is like one of those entertainment questions here, because I believe there's a level of history about especially martial arts and our urban connection that most people haven't told. My ultimate quest is show how martial arts and even Bruce Lee doing Five Fingers of Death, before Bruce Lee came was Five Fingers of Death. You know, those movies, how they influence such a creative expression of youth. And I was one of them, along with the sounds and beats of the streets, which we now call hip hop. Those things, without them things evolving, still when I tell people, no, martial arts and hip hop is all the same. It was all connected. People are like, no, how is that even possible? But you know more about that. How does those things parallel together? They were being developed at the same time.
Yeah. Thank you, brother. I would say humbly that I heard hip hop for years before it was ever recorded. Yes, in fact, one of my funniest stories I would tell you is when I first heard hip hop, it was on my block. I used to live in Harlem. And the guys, they would run, they'd have the turntables, and they'd go up until they would pop the side of a light pole, as you can plug into the light pole. That's how you get your power.
Okay, and they would play music.
And so I said, wow, I really like this. I said, what record is that? I would sneak up behind him and look over his shoulder and look at the record, right? That sounds good. So the next day I went to the record store and bought the record. And I put it on. I said, this is not what I heard. Then I realized they were scratching the record. They would take on the beats off the record.
Okay.
But the first time you hear it, man, this is like, shit, man, this is 79, you know, 77, 79, 78, 79, early. And I used to go, man, I really became interested in hip hop. So I remember going to a roller skate rink, man, in Queens. And Kumo D was performing, not on stage. He was on the floor, like everybody else. I mean, I saw all the early guys before they were famous.
Right.
And so it became, and Russell Simmons, I knew Russell Simmons when he was still doing parties at the college and stuff. So I was there when the whole thing was created. And I was really fascinated by the social aspect of hip hop, which the people were fighting all the time. And he said, look here, let's battle on the mic rather than just the fist. Let's battle on dance floor, break dance. It was a way to take that energy, that male conflict, and transfer it into an artistic competition as opposed to somebody going home, stabbed, cut, shot, broken this, broken that. And I think that's the untold story of hip hop. And I'm currently a member of the advisory board of the Universal Hip Hop Museum that's being built in the Bronx.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things I keep reminding myself, we need to tell that story that hip hop came out of civilizing urban conditions that put us against each other. Hip hop was something that grew out of the culture to make peace. Hip hop is the art of peace. And of course it get off track, because I really feel that my generation that made House Party, hip hop was peace. It was, you know, it was having fun. And then in 1990, it took a turn. It became pathological. It became fratricide, became anti-female, you know, and killing all that. That's something I personally believe, you know, this is me talking now, that corporate America saw that hip hop, specifically with Public Enemy, and I know the producers of those albums, Public Enemy, that level of consciousness was threatening to them. But they had to introduce another element to neutralize it, to reverse it. So Public Enemy was neutralized by NWA and Ice-T and everybody else began talking the violent stuff. But it wasn't that, man. There was a period, first of fun, and then later consciousness, and corporate America said, no, we got culture will either help make a community healthy or will destroy it. And hip hop was healthy, and then they flipped it. It became destructive.
And you know, it's interesting because my story, when I was locked up, Kumo D, Knowledge is King, Poor Righteous Teachers, Holy Intellect, KRS-One, The Blueprint of Hip Hop.
That's right.
Gangstar, These Are the Words That I Manifest. That there we go again, where people don't understand to a youth that was lost. It saved my life.
Yes, sir.
It's those elements, all those things once again And I think that's why even this show and the things that you're doing and everything that we're doing, I believe it's my duty to pass it on to the next generation.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I got to awaken their minds. I mean, was it, you know, all the things that that music did for us, it's the kid that was on before you came on, we have this thing that we talking about. It's called 1 out of 100. Mm. 1% of the people control the wealth. Mm-hmm. But that one kid out of that 100 that can make it, that kid got to be strong, just like that 1% that can control the wealth.
Yeah.
1% that make it out of poverty and struggle got to be real powerful. And the power that that 1% has can change more than one other person. That's they right. can change 20 or 30 if they have the support and the help and the consciousness to do that. I mean,
absolutely.
What do you say about that, sir?
Without a doubt. I mean, what's the famous saying? What's a black belt? A black belt is a white belt who never quit.
Never quit, yes.
You
sir.
Know, so sad to say, it ain't for everybody. Everybody ain't gonna make it. But we look for the one where you see the potential and you give that person support, and they will make it, and they in turn need to reverse. It's paying it forward. I've been so blessed, brother. I've had people like, I mentioned Melvin Peoples, but also Harry Belafonte, somebody who took a personal interest in me and that coached me and told me which way to go. And each of us, I think, have obligation to touch and pass it on, pay it forward. And we can always start with one. We can always start with one. And as long as that flame, so to speak, that's why in the Olympics, they carry the torch.
Okay.
And
they
try to take from this to that. And so if we do that, then we have done our responsibility.
Yes, sir.
And we cannot be opposed. We will be opposed, but we cannot be stopped or deterred.
Well, on my show, as we're bringing this to a close, I just have one little request I want to ask you.
Okay.
And this is something that I want to say to the world, and they might see it and they might reject it, but this thing just like inspired me. The documentary that's on Netflix called Crack. I need to tell everybody that's listening to this, if you want to understand the insanity and the things that, because a lot of times when I talk about what I went through during that era, people are like, oh man, well, why would you do that? They don't understand that at that time, circumstances didn't give us nothing but a choice to do that. The documentary is so powerful. Even to see the political reins in the prison system, it's not just a bunch of kids trying to sell drugs. It's so much more to it than that. And that documentary, whoever put that together, sir, it grabbed me. It was so real.
I know the producer and the director, the fantastic filmmakers, Stanley Nelson and Keith Brown. You know what? Can I also give another recommendation on the same topic? The exact same topic. It's not a documentary, though. It's a drama. And it's in season 3 now on FX. And I hope you've heard of it, but somebody who's watching may have heard of it. It's called Snowfall.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, Snowfall, it gets into the politics because the government, the CIA, needed to find that the government was prohibited from funding the Contras. And so Ronald Reagan, specifically, Ronald Reagan needed to get cash. They made a deal to turn the cocaine traffic, which turned into the crack traffic, to cash to fund weapons, you know, to fight the against the Contras in Nicaragua. So the crack epidemic in the United States has a CIA fingerprints all over. And this is widely documented. This is not me just being a conspiracy guy. That is documented by a variety of sources. But oftentimes, our community, we just victimized, man. And even the sentencing of crack versus cocaine. I mean, cocaine, because that's become the drug of the elite. But poor people, you know, take the crack drug. And again, back to entrepreneurship, because a person couldn't get the opportunity to be a car salesman or a real estate broker or any other kinds of things, you know, any kind of businesses, you do commerce, you go to what's available. So drug was as a business. No, it's a destructive business, but it is a business.
Yes.
And people know how to do it, made a lot of money.
But why is it that every race of people that came to this country use illegal activity to get to a point and then disconnect and go into politics? But why is it that there's one race of people that continue to be labeled as the thugs and the bad people when they're just doing the exact same thing that every other race did?
Because that's called racism and white supremacy. The half his let me give you another.
I'm sorry, sir. I had to ask the question,
you got to ask it. Of course, that question makes perfect sense. But let me, I like the fact that we have these movie references. That's my specialty. You know? And so there's another movie that's playing now. And this is something you can actually watch for free. You go to FX.com. FX is, of course, a cable channel. And it's season four. I emphasize this. Season four of it's called Fargo. It's 11 episodes and it stars Chris Rock. But it's not a comedy. This is not a comedy. This is drama. Chris Rock plays a gangster. It's brilliant. I mean, I know Chris Rock, obviously, you know, for many, many, many years. And I didn't know he could do this. It is brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And and it talks about what you just said. Why is each generation? It shows, the whole thing takes place in 1950 in Kansas City, Missouri. And it shows each wave of immigration, the Italians, the Chinese, the Irish, and finally Black people. And you see in this story how each person came to America, put into the crime box, and made a transition. So I tell you, brother, I'm giving you my personal guarantee. This will be, you will love this. You're gonna call me and say, man, I noticed this is so good. And Chris Rock, you wouldn't believe him. And he plays this incredible gangster. And his generation is the last generation, which was Blacks and Italians. But before that, we see the Irish and Chinese. We see all the people going through that cycle. So here's a way where you can learn the lesson without it being a documentary, without it being purely educational. It's entertaining.
Yes, okay.
And so Fargo, season four on FX.com.
Well, when you talk about being entertained, I think Karis one when he say edutainment. Would you like to say anything to any of the listeners out there? Anything you got coming up, or anything that you like to put out there to the people?
My rule is I don't talk about what I'm going to do. I talk about what I've done.
Yes, sir.
So when something's like done and you can come see it, then I'll talk about it. Yes, otherwise, I learned the hard way. Let me tell you how I learned this. It's called life lessons. So years ago, I mean, back in 1990-something, I had became friends. Me and my brother became friends with George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic. We were hardcore funketeers. And you know, by you from D.C., Maryland, you know about funk, you know.
Yes, sir.
And so we said, man, we want to make the mothership connection, man. Make a sci-fi. We were psyched. He's okay. I'm with it. So we went to the Hollywood studio. So listen, man, he said, yeah, it's okay. We trust you. You know, you did House Party, so we trust you. He said, here's the money. So I went back, said, okay, I got the money. He said, okay, well, let's get started. And then I got a call from the music department. I said, what's wrong? He says, well, you know, before we start production, we got to make sure all the legal is clear with the music. And George has known him on the music. What are you talking about? He told me he did. I mean, he's you know, he wrote it. He did it. He performed it. He said, no, he don't own it. And I said, what? Turns out, in the days when George was caught up in the drugs, he signed over anybody who gave him some drugs. He signed over the rights. And so I had millions of dollars, but millions of dollars. I was ready to go. And he didn't have it. If you could see my face, but I was, you know, and then again, I understand when you get caught up, you know, but we were, that movie. So anyway, the reason I told you that story was I had told you, I'm getting ready to do the P-Funk movie. And it, yeah, man, P-Funk, oh yeah. And then I said, no, I'm not going to do it. So that was my lesson. Talk about it after you. Because to this day, people say, what happened to P-Funk movie? I said, it's embarrassing. It's not my fault, but it's embarrassing. Talk about why something didn't happen, you know?
Yes, sir.
That was my lesson.
Well, you're my hero, and I say that from my heart and soul. And I say that to any kid out there, dreams do come true. I don't care how low you are. When you surrender and you allow God to guide you, God do for you what you can't do for yourself. And you, it's an honor, sir. It's always an honor when we get a chance to talk and you give me an interview. So thank you for this weekend.
But brother, I tell you, let me come back with you, brother. Your talks, whether it be on the internet program or in person, you are so inspirational, man. It in many ways, man, you embarrass me because I need to be working harder. I've had more advantages than you. I need to be doing more. And so what if I see what you do, when each of us step forward and do more, that's good. My favorite expression is steel sharpens steel. But brother, you made it steel and you sharpened me. So I thank you.
Thank you. That goes back to my mind. You know, that's who it is. So thank you, sir.
All right, brother.
Saijin.
The warrior's mindset is about conditioning the mind, body, and spirit. It takes practice, commitment, vision, goal setting, determination, sharp focus, respect, and discipline. Once you learn it, you can apply it to all aspects of your life. The warrior's mindset prepares you for the largest competition ever, the competition against self.